This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Off the Hook. Coming up, it's almost 7 p.m.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7 o'clock. Time, once again, for Off the Hook. The Hook, Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Over here.
And Alex over there.
Good evening.
And we don't have Robin Gill tonight, so it's going to be kind of a skeleton crew, which is okay. You know, we can do that. And we have overtime coming up at 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel. Go to channel 2600 on YouTube to get the exact method of clicking, or go to the 2600.com webpage and you'll see it up on top. And you can phone in. You can call us during that segment, since you can't call us during this segment that goes over the radio. So we weren't on last week, and a lot has happened. We want to talk about the Colonial Pipeline, certainly, because, boy, that was a story. But first, before we do that, I think it's important to emphasize, for fear of people maybe losing track, thinking everything is okay again. Yeah, you know, we're taking the first cautious steps into normalcy, and that's a good thing. Weird, though, how the very people who were fighting this tooth and nail all the way are now fighting normalcy tooth and nail all the way, saying it's got to be some kind of a conspiracy here. You can't be happy unless there's a conspiracy. So, yeah, us saying it's okay now to not wear masks in certain situations and to go about life as if you're vaccinated against a deadly disease, that's suspicious somehow. And as I heard this, there's actually people who are putting on masks now because they are afraid of catching something from people who have been vaccinated. I couldn't make this up. So vaccination apparently is the disease now in these people's minds. And if you don't want to catch the vaccine, you got to wear a mask. You know, it works for me. That's fine. If that gets you wearing a mask and you're not vaccinated, okay, great. Maybe you should stay inside, too, and just, you know, let this play out. Alex, you're out there in Pennsylvania, it looks like?
I am. I'm out here in beautiful Pennsylvania in the Pocono Mountains. But I will say, I mean, you guys haven't been to Manhattan or to New York City for, I think, quite a while, but the city right now feels like a wholly different place than it did last year. But I was chiming in not to talk about that. I think the city is bouncing back. It feels great. I feel like we're going to be in the studio before we know it. But I want to talk specifically about Long Island and the vaccine and something to which I was invited to.
Why do I have a feeling this is going to be insulting? go ahead. There's a lot that needs fixing out here, for sure.
Most things that I say, I guess, are slightly insulting to Long Island, Queens, you know, various places, et cetera. So, you know, get used to it, or you should be used to it. But in any event, on Facebook earlier this week, a friend of mine from high school had invited me to a special Facebook group that was called something like Show Your Face Long Island.
It's a trap. Don't fall for it.
Well,
I'm sorry. That's just my go-to reaction for anything involving Facebook. But okay, continue.
What happened?
Absolutely. But I looked at it, and this is a person whom I respect. I think very highly of her. She's an intelligent woman, but yet she keeps inviting me to the same Facebook group, and it's all about not wearing masks indoors at various stores or restaurants. And what people do is they post photos of themselves inside these stores, restaurants, whatever they are, hardware stores, Lowe's, Home Depot, and will record a video or some kind of statement about whether they were mistreated for not wearing a mask. So they're reporting on this, and there's lots of other people that have joined in on, you know, what I guess the air quoting fun here. And it's really scary to me because when you see these pictures of people who are not vaccinated, they're not wearing masks, they're indoors, they're flouting all these regulations. They are talking to each other, they're touting, or they're fluffing each other up about this as well, mm-hmm. giving each other increased confidence. But the argument that they're using, I would like to know where it's coming from, because it goes like this. It says, well, why should I have to wear a mask? Because if the vaccine is so effective. Well, think about it. Actually, I missed the premise here. Why should I have to wear a mask? Because wearing a mask protects other people. It doesn't necessarily protect me. So if the vaccine is so effective, then why do I have to wear a mask?
Because I'm an inconsiderate dumbass who doesn't care about anybody else. You're pretty much wearing that, you know, as a banner.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. And what people don't really understand is that, you know, there are still people that are extremely vulnerable. Not everybody is vaccinated. There are some elderly people who may not be able to acquire the vaccine or have the vaccine injected in them because they might have some kind of adverse reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
I know several people like that. And the fundamental flaw here, I think, is in two stages with this argument, is that it's not always about you. It's not always about yourself, right? And not wearing a mask, we get it. Okay, you're protecting third parties, but sometimes you have a duty to third parties. Sometimes you have a duty to protect others who are more vulnerable than you. And
I would doubt that with them. I don't think they ever consider themselves having that duty.
I'm sure that they don't. And based on the commentary that I've been seeing in this particular group, it certainly doesn't seem to have come under scrutiny or any kind of extended consideration. I will say, too, though, that I think it's just a fundamental lack of compassion.
Yeah, and misplaced values, because, you know, I see the argument many, many times about, well, this is an issue of individual rights and privacy, and I shouldn't be told what to do, and I shouldn't have to prove that I got a vaccine because that's an invasion of my privacy. All, you know, great values to hang on to, but when they're outweighed by public safety, and you know, unless you don't believe that COVID-19 actually is a thing, then you have to sort of say, well, it's important that we stay as safe as possible and that I act like a responsible person. That's more important than clinging to some belief that if I show a card that says I got a vaccine, somehow that's the beginning of an Orwellian society. Believe me, we're well into it, and you already have to show ID for other things, and there are so many examples that exceed the concerns that people have right now about this. It's trivial. It's minor. And the far greater problem right now is, are we going to get through this? Because we need to be at around 70% of full vaccination for us to be in the safe zone. You know, when you have an ice cream cone, it's one of the you know, soft kind, you have to get to the point where it's level so that it doesn't start dripping when it melts. Okay, we're not anywhere near the level part. We still have an awful lot to go, and it's melting. And when it starts dripping, that's when, you know, we go back to dark days. Now, the CDC has changed things. They say you don't have to wear a mask in various situations right now. And I have mixed feelings about that because it's a lot of it is relying on the honor system, and many people have proven they are not honorable. So I don't know, Alex, how you feel about going into a store or something indoors without your mask, without and other people not wearing masks, and everybody just believing that everyone else got the vaccine, and that's pretty much what they are saying by not having a mask in a situation like that. Maybe I'm just not somebody who trusts by default, but I just think we've seen so much over the past year of people who behave like idiots and don't think of the common good, and basically cast aside science, which is what this really is all about. And you know, when you see somebody, whether it's, you know, on the M14 bus, or whether it's on the floors of Congress, or, you know, just wandering around in circles someplace, and they're making these arguments, and all the people that they're arguing against are doctors and scientists, and they're all part of some kind of conspiracy and plot. You know, when you find yourself in that situation, I hope there is some part of you that can just step back a second and say, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, I'm arguing against all the people that know what they're talking about, and I admittedly don't know what I'm talking about. I have an opinion, everyone does, but I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor. You know, the people who know what they're talking about, who have spent the last year in emergency rooms and dealing with victims of this horrible disease, those are the people that we should be listening to far and above people with political agendas who don't have the slightest clue.
It seems like a weirdly specific and stupid form of exhibitionism, like pandemic scofflaws, feeling unbridled, and then documenting this kind of behavior. And in itself, is it helping? Is it hurt? It's definitely not helping. But, you know, you proving that you can break that specific rule, is that is that saying very much? I don't know. I don't really think so. As like a first impression, and the overall issue itself. I mean, it's about the benefit to a kind of greater societal good, and that goal, given the circumstances, can be attained through this very kind of low cost measure in wearing a mask, and that. Sight seems kind of, it just, you know, it's not very, there's not a lot there. I mean, you're not saying, as I said, not saying much. It mm-hmm. can backfire and be actually more hurtful because, yeah, you might not get something, you might not hurt somebody else given that, but it still is, a behavior that could impact someone and you're doing a lot of this in some regards to set an example and to reassure people that you're conscientious and of their space and so forth. So yeah. It has been effective, I think, overall. And as I said, it's like sort of a lower cost.
But you know, the decisions we make always affect other people. So you're not just making a decision for yourself. If you refuse to get the vaccine, you're putting other people at risk. If you refuse to wear a mask, you're putting other people at risk. It goes beyond that. Always has. You know, if you make a society where people are encouraged to act irresponsibly, and there's all kinds of examples we can point to in our current society, you're making things more dangerous and unpleasant for people in the future and setting us back, for your own interest, for your own amusement. So we need to be able to, always look at the common good. The common good being what is best for you know, for most people, and you know, I hear the argument that the vaccine is I think what is it, Kyle, not approved? That's the phrase.
Oh well, that's the emergency use was it was authorized for emergency use,
right.
And it was called the EUA. That's the acronym, but it is yet to be approved. But
okay,
so
the whole argument there is that it's not approved, therefore it's dangerous. No, what you said about the emergency use, it's an emergency. you know, what part of that don't you get? It's an emergency, so that's why it has this categorization. It's moving incredibly fast. It, and as you said, it will be approved. But, yeah, everything carries a small degree of risk. There is no question about that. Everything does. But this is something that we have to weigh our survival as a species and a society and say, is this the right thing to do? And if you can find scientists and doctors who are standing up and saying, no, this is wrong, listen to them. Absolutely. I'm not hearing it. Not hearing very much of that. In fact, you know, most this is an interesting story that someone forwarded to us. Most anti-vaccine conspiracies online, they come from the same 12 people. 12 people. this blew me away. According to recent research, a large chunk of this very big problem actually has a very small starting point. In a new study, researchers found the majority of anti-vaccine conspiracy circulating on social media can be traced to a mere handful of individual accounts representing prominent anti-vaccine personalities. In all, just 12 of these people and their organizations, the so-called disinformation dozen, and I did not name them that, are responsible for initiating up to 65% of all false and misleading anti-vaccine propaganda shared on Facebook and Twitter. Not surprising when you think of how Facebook and Twitter work, that it's a small amount of people that actually do this kind of a thing. Per the research, we get to name names, the disinformation dozen behind almost two-thirds of anti-vaccine content shared in the study window includes, everybody ready? Got your pens? Joseph Mercola, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., okay, he surprises me, Ty and Charlene Bollinger, they count as two, right? There's two people, Ty and Charlene. Sherry Tenpenny, that's got to be a British name. Reza Islam, also an interesting name. Rashid Buttar, Erin Elizabeth, Sayer G, Kelly Brogan, Christian Northrup, Ben Tapper, and Kevin Jenkins. Okay, so there you go. If your source of information is one of those 12, you're part of the 65% that that is included in this study. Alex, I know you had something to contribute.
Yeah, I was checking out that particular Facebook group that I had mentioned before.
It's a trap. I'm sorry.
It is. It is certainly a trap. But I wanted to mention, I mean, this is happening literally 42 minutes ago now. Somebody made a post about a particular diner on Long Island.
Uh-oh.
And it says this. We just went into the California diner in Patchogue. I had no mask on. They said I needed a mask. I said CDC and New York State lifted the mask mandate. The manager was nasty. So the California diner in Patchogue is making people wear masks. And then a bunch of people commented, guess where I'm not going to eat? Let's make a list, et cetera, et cetera.
Hang on. You're saying that if somebody in an establishment refuses entry to a bunch of dumbasses who don't want to follow the rules, then that establishment won't get visited by those dumbasses. Sounds like a good policy to me.
Yeah. Well, that's actually... But, you know, the unintended consequence there, I guess, is absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
What this strikes me as is I feel like, okay, there's certainly disinformation here, and there's certainly political components to it, anti-vax issues. There's a lot of it, too. But I think fundamentally there's a psychological problem with a lot of these people in refusing to wear a mask, refusing the vaccine, or complaining about a diner that has been on Long Island for a very, very long time, California diner.
Back when we were in California, back in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic diner right on Sunrise Highway, right next to
the... I don't know. I've never heard of it. We're not promoting them. That could be terrible.
We're not promoting them, but I would say, look, it's a good spot. But in any event, these people that get refused entry or are treated badly because they're not wearing a mask or not following the rules, I think that they like the opportunity to play the victim.
Of course. Have you ever been on an IRC channel? It's the same thing. You want the attention. You want to act like an idiot because idiots get all the headlines. And look what all the headlines are about.
Yeah, and this is so tempting. This is an opportunity for people, you know, white middle-class individuals, to act like idiots and to play the victim because they've never been the victim. Yeah, well, I would say, look, I won't say categorically they've never been a victim, but I think a good portion of them have not ever suffered a kind of persecution based on a characteristic like this.
Well, this is the kind of cross they want to die on. You know, I'll do the hammering. I mean, seriously, this is ridiculous. We need to get through this together. And the fact that we are actually at a stage now where people can go to New York City and we're starting to see things get back to normal, that is incredible. That is great news. And the only reason that's happening is because people are getting vaccinated. Unfortunately, not enough. And I fear that in a few weeks or a couple of months, we might see numbers start spiking again. Because if there are enough unvaccinated people walking around, it won't take much for another spread. Or perhaps a variant might get through that doesn't respond well to the or gets past the vaccine. And then we're all back in the boat again. So that's something rather disturbing.
Yeah, and I think there's a distinction to be made here, too. Is there are certain people that have been on the fence about the vaccine, and some of them have reasonable arguments for wanting to not get vaccinated immediately. And I think we have to acknowledge that.
Sure, okay, absolutely.
About it, but there's and that's okay. It's okay, but now I think is the time to remove that hesitancy, to move forward, to go and get vaccinated. We've had millions and millions of people be vaccinated. If you're watching Tucker Carlson at night, mm-hmm. you think it's a health crisis being vaccinated. It's absolutely not the case. You need to widen the swath of information from which you're receiving data about this vaccine. But, okay, that's one thing. That's one issue here, not being vaccinated. The other issue of not wearing a mask or thinking that you have an entitlement to not wear a mask in a private establishment that wants you to wear a mask, there's no excuse for that. Mm-hmm. That's just plain and simple idiocy. And I think that it's important to distinguish between those two issues.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah, and there's already pressure on these small businesses and venues and transit and all of the different parts of society. And this liability, you know, they know their foot traffic, they know the scheme of day-to-day operations better, so a lot of the responsibility is on them, but you don't need to put undue pressure just to agitate.
Okay, well, let's just to close this out, if you are interested in getting vaccinated and you're in the New York area, it's never been simpler. It's never been simpler than now. You can get a vaccine today. Well, maybe it's a little late today, but it's certainly a lot easier than it was a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago. You can call 877-VAX4NYC. That's 877-829-4692. And that will allow you to schedule an appointment or request free transportation to a vaccine site. Or get this. You can even request in-home vaccination if you're homebound and can't get out. Somebody will come to your house with a needle, and it's not nearly as bad as it sounds, but that can actually be arranged if that's what you want. But it's super simple, and that's just in New York City. Just go on the web, look up COVID-19 vaccine near me, and you'll likely get a whole bunch of options, and you can get it done quickly. And get back to normal quickly. Isn't that what we all want? It's just so funny to see us getting back to normal, and the same people are now complaining about that. Oh, boy. Okay, so looking forward to coming back at some point. But again, you know, that's up to the station as to when they deem it safe. They are their own entity. And just like anyone, any business or a home, or building, they have the right to determine when it's safe, when they believe it's safe for people to actually return. But for now, going to New York City, walking around, that's becoming normal again, and that's a good thing. And yes, Alex, you're right, we have not actually been to Manhattan in a while, and looking forward to seeing it again, seeing what's changed, kind of dreading seeing what's changed, all the businesses that might not be there anymore. And that's one of the real tragedies of this. If you know of businesses that are struggling, help them out. And there are so many ways you can do that. Just frequent their establishments or order something from them or just be there. You know, be present. That matters more than you can possibly imagine. Yes, Alex?
You're going to be very surprised, and I think pleasantly surprised in one sense, too, because the whole character of the city, I feel like, is starting to bounce back. Mm-hmm. What was lost especially in Manhattan, was that buzz, that vibe that you felt whenever you would leave your apartment. You stepped out onto the street and wherever you were, and you felt like there was this energy. But that energy was really missing for, mm-hmm. I would say, a little over a year, maybe about 13, 14 months. It felt like it was gone. It feels like it's back now. It's becoming a fun place again. You're starting to see a lot more people on the streets that aren't wearing masks. You know, and that's a little bit scary, but a lot of people are vaccinated. They're outside. Yeah, it's also a lot different because you're going to see now, Emmanuel, all of these outdoor dining kiosks that have cropped up on almost every single street. And I hope that they stay there for the foreseeable future because it's extra seating for these restaurants. It's fun to sit out there. And, you know, you're kind of part of the street scenery. It's become part of the city to see all of these almost pop-up-like structures that mm-hmm. are outdoor dining. And, yeah, the weather is ripe for it now. Now is the time to go out and support your local restaurants, get out there, have fun in Manhattan. It's or any one of the five boroughs of New York City. It's a different place. It's bouncing back. And I want to be there when you guys first return. Promise me that.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll be notified. But, yes, the outdoor dining is a great thing. Probably one of the best things to come out of COVID-19, if there are any good things that came out of it, that change, making that permanent. But we need to make it safe as well. We can't have cars plowing into diners. It's happened a couple of times. We need to make those structures safe, just like we need to make bike lanes safe from cars. These are things that I guess the next mayor, whoever that may be, will have a big say in it. But we as people have a voice as well, and we should exercise that. Okay, let's move on. We were talking about IRC a little bit, and boy, there is a bit of a war going on IRC, but this time we're not involved. It's the Freenode, IRC network. They have experienced a massive resignation of staff, and that's after control of Freenode passed to what one of them described as, and this is a quote, a narcissistic Trumpian wannabe Korean royalty Bitcoins millionaire. That's what they said. I don't know what most of that means, but it's not a positive characterization of the person taking over Freenode. So what has happened here is that the open source communications network was sold a couple of years ago, actually, and at the time, it appeared there would not be any radical changes and that everything would continue as normal. And apparently, that is no longer the case. According to this article here, during the past few months in general and the last weeks in particular, it has become increasingly clear that the owners of the holding company, Freenode LTD, have been planning a hostile takeover of the Freenode network. That takeover is now about to happen. And I cannot in good faith volunteer for this new Freenode. I'm reading a quote from an ex-employee. Freenode LTD's current owner's values do not align with the values Freenode, the network, was founded on and operated up until now. Here's from another ex-employee. To make a long story short, the former Freenode head of staff secretly sold the network to this person, even if it was not hers to sell, and our lawyers have advised us that there is not much that we can do about it without some of us risking financial ruin. So, boy, there's some drama going on here. You thought you'd seen IRC drama before, but, boy, this is something unprecedented. Now, the new owner has a side to the story, as you might expect, and they say, given the millions I have injected into Freenode thus far, the fact I own it, and the fact that I protected the Freenode staff with professional legal work and funding when they needed help and they could still lie and slander like this says a lot about who they are. It saddens me that Christel was forced out, and I wish she'd feel safe returning. I'm frustrated. I'm naming names here. I don't know exactly who they are, but they're obviously key players. I'm frustrated that Tamal's hostile takeover seems likely to succeed in spite of it all. I simply want Freenode to keep on being a great IRC network and to support it financially and legally as I have for a long time now. That's from the the new owner, who is saying that a hostile takeover is in progress, and apparently he's not involved in that. Andrew Lee is the name of the new owner, and he recently profiled in the South China Morning Post in an unflattering display, apparently. Founded 26 years ago, home to some 80,000 users, over 40,000 channels, the Freenode is reportedly the largest IRC network and has enjoyed something of a roller coaster history. A number of those resigning have established a new IRC network. You knew they were going to do that. That new IRC network, get your pens ready, is libera.chat. That's libera.chat. Okay, and that's where you can go to follow the story and not be on Freenode. Or you can go to our IRC network. We've had that for a bunch of years, irc.2600.net. You won't see any drama. No, you'll see plenty of drama there, but it's the nature of the beast. But, boy, this is what do you think of this story, Alex?
There's a lot, I think, that requires additional explanation here as well. Everyone's calling this a hostile takeover, but it seems like the company was willingly sold.
Supposedly by somebody who didn't have the right to sell it, according to some?
Perhaps, but if there's no legal recourse, then apparently whoever sold it did have the right to sell it, or the person is a bona fide purchaser of the company. It would take a hell of a lot to unwind that particular transaction. It might be a very costly battle. But it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to me to have the sale of a company occur in 2017 really for no reason whatsoever. If everything was going to run based on the status quo of what Freenode was doing at that particular time, it doesn't necessarily make sense to have some Bitcoin millionaire from Korea with royal ties to take over the company. So what I would like to know, and I'm sure what a whole bunch of others were probably wondering too, is what else has been happening since 2017 with Freenode? Have there been any things going on, any undercurrents that could affect these open source projects? I mean, Freenode is used for a massive amount of open source project collaboration, and I think this is certainly going to affect those open source projects. But the other issue I have here, too, is two other points, is that it seems like something was brewing in February when this individual, who apparently didn't have the right to sell the company, even sold the company, put on the logo, put a shells.com logo on Freenode, which apparently is a company that was co-founded by Andrew Lee, who bought Freenode, and this other individual by the name of Mark Coppella, who many of us will remember from Mt. Gox. And Mt. Gox was a massive Bitcoin exchange, one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges I think that the world has ever seen, operating out of Tokyo. And they lost, I think it was around 850,000 Bitcoin back in 2014. And according to multiple sources, and it's my opinion as well, a lot of that was on account of theft and mismanagement and probably, in all likelihood, a bunch of fraud as well. A huge amount of those Bitcoins has been recovered. In fact, an entire cottage industry has popped up about recovery of Mt. Gox Bitcoins, which are obviously extremely valuable now. But having that individual associated with Freenode is certainly something I imagine a lot of these developers and people that have been with Freenode possibly for decades would just not want to have. Now, here's the other interesting thing that I picked up when reading this story as well, is that you mentioned Libra.chat, Emmanuel, which is the new domain name. It's in the .chat top-level domain, which is a new generic top-level domain that came out a few years ago. But if you look up Libra.chat, it was actually created not within the last few days. It was created on the 23rd of April of 2021. So that also indicates to me that something was brewing here beneath the surface over at Freenode, and people a few weeks ago knew something was coming down.
Who is the person mentioned in this story that was leaving or changing, that was aggrieved? There's a notice there from my connection logs. It just says, "Hi all, So my it feels like my moral responsibility to inform all users administrative control of Freenode and its user data will soon change hands, and I'll be resigning from Freenode's staff effective immediately. It's been an honor to help you all.
Well, it sounds like that's a message that's being echoed by many people at Freenode right now.
Yeah, so this must be part of some of the exodus. And I noticed in IRC, which I occasionally check, there was some other activity. It seemed like operational or like network stuff, but I haven't looked back at that either. But I was unaware of this. So should I disconnect?
Connected and watch what happens.
I guess maybe that's the thing, is figure out where it goes from here.
I'd still be connected to Parler right now. They didn't kick me off. You know, it's basically you want to watch the entertainment. But
fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and it's just weird to think. I can't find anywhere how much Freenode sold for back in 2017. But I imagine it was probably a hefty sum, and it's just weird to think of these networks attaining so much value, things that we kind of took for granted in the early days, just as a gathering place, a place where people shared their passion for something like open source software. Alex?
Well, you bring up a really good issue to me, because I'm sure a lot of people are very curious about what the sale price was, but also there should be something, some legal document that reflects a sale, that memorializes the sale. Usually a purchase and sale agreement is something that would accompany the purchase of an asset like this. And that purchase and sale agreement may have certain obligations that the new owner is taking on to do or to not do. And I would love to be able to get my hands on that. I think, you know, if somebody at Freenode has got access to it, I think that that's a very big missing piece of this jigsaw puzzle.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting story. Interesting story. And we'll see how that plays out, but IRC drama just on a massive scale, one that we've probably never seen before. But Alex, you mentioned the Bitcoin hack
it was Mt. Gox.
Mt. Gox.
Yeah, one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges in Tokyo.
Well, there was also another hack called Bitfinex. I think I'm pronouncing it right. These aren't words. I'm sorry. I can pronounce it however I want. Bitfinex, that's how I'm choosing to pronounce this. And that was another crypto exchange. They had a hacking incident back in 2016. So what's interesting about this is that they say the assets that were stolen are going to take over a century to get cashed out. That's according to the blockchain intelligence firm Elliptic. And I just think it's cool that there's a blockchain intelligence firm out there. Remaining 21% of this hack has been moved around by the malicious cyber attackers, but they've only managed to launder 4% of their total haul, and that's $270 million. So I don't know if I'm supposed to feel good about this, but they've only gotten $270 million instead of the $7 billion that they stole. Elliptic pointed out that the reason for their particular conclusion is the evolution of crypto tracking tools, regulations, and law enforcement methodologies that make stolen or ill-gotten digital assets very challenging to cash out today. Yeah, it's no longer something simple that you can just get away with. The intelligence company explained that the hackers used something called peel chains to exchange the stolen funds. In this method, crypto tokens are moved around numerous times, moving fast from wallet to wallet, and only a small amount of the Bitcoin is peeled off to their actual destination along the way. Now, back then, it was extremely hard to track crypto assets laundered using this method, but today, the emergence of automatic tracing systems capable of determining the ultimate source or funds in an address makes the job a lot easier for the authorities. Yeah, the authorities are on top of this. After the successful attack on Bitfinex in 2016, the laundering process started in 2017 through the largest darknet market at that time, which we all know is... No? No guesses? AlphaBay. They teach this in schools.
Yeah, they're gone.
Elementary school kids know this history.
Sure.
Yeah, they're gone. They're gone. But later that year, it was shut down by law enforcement, prompting the move to...
BetaBay.
No. They're the biggest illegal marketplace today, kids. Come on, we all know the name.
2600.
Very funny, Alex. Very funny.
Oh,
discuss this.
No,
later.
I don't remember.
Hydra.
Oh, of
yeah.
Course.
Crypto Slate. I don't know who Crypto Slate is, but they are citing part of the report from Elliptic stating, after a hiatus in 2019, the launderers returned to Hydra in 2020. I feel like I'm reading a science fiction novel, and are currently depositing $3 million of the stolen Bitcoin every month. So their income has been slashed to $3 million a month. So I guess that's success. But you know, the thing is, all that money that was stolen is still not accessible to the people that rightfully owned it. So it's not really a happy ending here. And it's, I just imagine the frustration of those people that, you know, bought Bitcoin early on and said, you know what, I'll take 1,000 Bitcoin. What the hell? And then they lost access to it somehow, whether it was stolen or they just forgot the password. And now, well, of course, it's been plummeting lately, but, you know, it's when it does get high up, and even now, it'd be worth an incredible amount if only they had held on to the password or not been hacked in one way or another. So there's all kinds of risks involved here, and I think, as we've said many times, it's a fun project, you know, maybe not the most responsible project in the world, but you should never put in more than you can afford to lose, because likely you will lose it. Go ahead, Alex.
And I will say there are many, many, many different types of scams that are targeting cryptocurrency exchanges and individuals that are known to have accounts on cryptocurrency exchanges and monitoring the DNS for all different types of phishing and credentials harvesting. We see, especially within the last year, cryptocurrency exchanges being one of the most highly targeted types of attacks on individuals as well. And the other thing I would mention, too, is that, I actually do investigate and trace stolen Bitcoins.
Uh-oh.
As well, and do have it.
I didn't know you did this.
Yeah, we do. We do it through my law firm. And we actually have an active case with respect to a large amount of stolen Bitcoin right now. And it is difficult. It's very difficult to track these things because the bad guys, obviously, they know that the more places, the more hops it takes, the more inputs and outputs that have to be traced, the more difficult it is. They use things called mixers, which you put in some Bitcoin and it goes and shoots out in all these different places algorithmically. It's very difficult to track and trace that. But they also use less sophisticated means of just regular coin swapping services that would have other legitimate reasons for existence aside from laundering money. But at the end of the day, it still is very difficult for these individuals to get the money out of the system. It's what's called edging out and going into fiat currency. And they'll use over-the-counter services. So let's say millions of Bitcoin are stolen. It becomes very difficult to actually turn that into cash because of all of these KYC requirements, because there's documentation, and because a lot of these exchanges want to cooperate with law enforcement these days because they want to be on larger exchanges. They want to be on Coinbase. They want to be on other bigger companies like Celsius as well. And in order to do that, you cannot countenance a large amount of fraud or money laundering happening on your network. So on the one hand, you know, all right, cooperating with law enforcement, some people would see that as not such a great thing. I see it as a very good thing for cryptocurrencies because it makes it more predictable. It makes it more usable. And more secure and stable.
Well, it's different than ratting out people for what they're buying with cryptocurrencies.
That's
you're basically just trying to return stolen cryptocurrencies from the very people that use your services.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But it is very dangerous, and there is a lot of cybersecurity-related hygiene that goes into having money in cryptocurrency as well. And if you are not following very strict best practices for how you manage your cryptocurrency wallets, you have a high likelihood, I think, of being scammed and possibly losing a lot of money. So, you know, giving some additional thought to cybersecurity best practices and handling wallets is certainly something to do.
Well, my suggestion, if you're a crypto criminal, is that what they call them? Somebody who has stolen a great deal or know people who have done this, and you find yourself in this rather awkward position where you're only getting a couple of million dollars a month now and you want to get it all. Well, you're not going to get it all. It's pretty obvious that it's going to get worse. So maybe work out a deal. Maybe they get some kind of a reward for giving it back. And then the people it was taken from, they get their money back, and you don't go to jail, and you get a little reward, and you never do it again. Does that sound reasonable? Or
Well, maybe. Yeah. I mean, look, there are, I believe there have been in the past some returns of stolen coins in exchange for non-prosecution arrangements. So there's also that to consider as well.
So if my words can help convince somebody who is sitting on a couple of billion dollars worth of Bitcoin now to return it to the rightful owners and get a small reward for that, maybe those rightful owners can give me a moderate reward for making the suggestion in the first place and helping them get their fortune back.
Or give it to a charity.
Or that.
Give it to India, the health system there, which is strapped, accepting donations.
Give it to the rainforest, since you're destroying the rainforest by using it in the first place.
I really truly believe that how you actually spend and use this kind of currency it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully people are thoughtful. They use their crypto assets responsibly.
There's been a lot of talk lately about the environmental impact of cryptocurrencies because of the huge amount of CPU power that needs to be used and the energy costs. And we as a community need to figure out a better way to do that so that it's not causing more problems than it's solving. That is number one, and it's hard to believe that this wasn't thought out from the beginning. So that's a challenge. All right, we said we were going to talk about Colonial Pipeline, and we're almost done with the show, and we haven't even started yet. So as you all know, Colonial Pipeline was hit with ransomware, and that slowed their supply of fuel to a crawl or to nothing. And what do you think happened? Of course, people in certain states, I won't name them, decided to panic and just basically buy all the gasoline they possibly could. And guess what? There was a gasoline shortage as a result of that. And then people in one particular part of the political spectrum decided to blame that on the current president. I don't know how you get there. I don't know how that is something that's in any way logical. It's Biden's gasoline crisis. Yeah, sure. Okay, whatever. So Colonial Pipeline basically was hit with this ransomware that shut down their operations temporarily. And they made a statement saying that they were not going to pay. They're not going to pay a ransom. And they were basically going to go that route. And it seemed like the right step to take, because I happen to agree with that. I happen to think that you should never pay a ransom. You should have backups. You should have, you know, a means of restoring, because there's all kinds of things that can happen. You know, a ransomware attack is only one crisis that can happen. Your provider can go out of business, a hurricane could hit, all sorts of things could happen that would make your data unattainable. And if you have a backup, at least you have something. Yeah, you'll lose however many days the backup is old, but you will at least have something. And I think every computer user at some point has lost a significant amount of data and has learned a lesson from that. If only I had kept a backup, this wouldn't have happened. Or if I had printed something out instead of just having it in one location. You know, there's all sorts of ways that you can fix things. And obviously, the bigger the company, the more complex it gets. But the concept is simple. Keep a damn backup. It seemed like that's what Colonial Pipeline was doing. And then word got out that, in fact, they paid $5 million to the hackers to get the data back. But apparently it was taking so long to get the data back from the hackers that they wound up restoring from backup anyway. So they just basically donated $5 million and got their data back through a backup in the end anyway. Really, really a crazy story. And it turns out the hacking group that was responsible for this was feeling somewhat guilty. They were basically saying they never meant to cause so much trouble, and they disbanded right afterwards, for whatever that's worth. The whole thing was just a carnival of weirdness, but not so atypical when you think about all the technological advancements and regressions that we've seen over the past few years and decades. Alex, what was your take on it?
You know, I want to respond to one of your points as well, which is that the need for backups, absolutely backups are critical if you're experiencing a ransomware event. But with more people taking proper backups as a precaution against ransomware, what the more sophisticated cyber adversaries are doing now, in addition to encrypting your data and charging you to decrypt it to get it back, that is they're telling you that if you do not pay the ransom, then they're going to release your information to the public.
Which they can do anyway.
Certainly, they can do that anyway. But it's not certain that they will do that. It wasn't certain that they would do that in the past. But, you know, that's a different type of threat that you cannot combat by a backup. Right? A backup isn't going to prevent your private or confidential data from your company, your trade secrets, perhaps, released out to the public. So it's another vector of consideration here. But you're absolutely right. And there's no guarantee, and you're dealing with these criminals. I tend to actually I do believe them when they said that they didn't intend to cause this much chaos, this much damage. They're ransomware criminals.
Does that mean, Alex? It could be 12-year-olds. You know, you can get ransomware software for like $30. Anybody can do this.
Sure. Sure, they can, absolutely. But, you know, it does take a certain amount of skill to get inside a network, to move around laterally, to figure out what's a critical place that you need to encrypt this data so that you can extract the maximum amounts of money. You have to have some skills. You have to have some knowledge.
I think you need more of a lack of security on the part of the victim than you do when they need skills on the part of the attacker.
Well, you know, look, there's so many weak links in any of these large organizations. I don't want to blame the victim for getting, you know, breached in this particular sense. But, of course, everybody needs to be doing better here. But I do think, you know, the payment of the ransomware was interesting. You're absolutely right, because it wasn't efficacious. It didn't work. But, on the other hand, going back to what we just talked about, that's another avenue by which these guys can be traced. I think they're going to be extremely careful about trying to edge out any of that $5 million into actual fiat currency. But, you know, the other, I think, component of this Colonial Pipeline ransomware that hasn't been all that discussed was that they seem to have taken their systems down and stopped the supply of gas, you know, at least on the East Coast of the United States, which affected gas prices everywhere. People were putting gasoline in plastic bags at gas stations. It was utter chaos and stupidity.
For no reason.
And I'm sure a lot of the people that were not wearing masks in diners as well were probably filling up gas tanks, or gas plastic bags with gas, rather. But I think that what's lost here is that Colonial seems to have taken down that system primarily because they couldn't bill their customers.
Yes, exactly.
That supply.
Right. It's about them billing the proper amount. They could have kept the flow going and sorted it out later, but as a business, they chose not to do that.
They chose not to do that, or they could have negotiated some kind of agreement with the federal government that said, look, we're hit here. You need to at least agree to indemnify us, bail us out. I mean, the federal government has a habit of bailing out businesses in trouble. I mean, think about all the massive amount of money that went through to PPP loans. Think about the banks that were bailed out. I don't necessarily understand why Colonial couldn't go to the federal government, negotiate something, even a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding about some kind of compensation for continuing to run a critical infrastructure oil pipeline, and who got hit, you know, with the cost here? I mean, the individuals, the consumers, the people that had to go spend upwards of $4 a gallon of gas. And I think, frankly, some people were injured or lost their lives in accidents.
None of that has anything to do with any of this. That's just people, again, being dumbasses. We've come back to where we started, and we're going to have to end it there. But we're going to continue this conversation on Overtime on our YouTube channel. You can get there by going to YouTube.com and typing in channel 2600. That's one word. Or going to 2600.com, looking at the top of the webpage, and you'll see a link there. And you can join us. You can phone in. You can be a part of Off the Hook. And you can also write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you. We will be back next week on the air. Keep listening to WBAI. And please support WBAI however you can. Give to WBAI.org. We'll see you next week. Good night.
You make me feel alright every waking hour and every lonely night. I've never been quite so alone.
Hannah from WBAI's Premiums Department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.